Welcome to Variant Frequencies. Month to month, our podcast brings you fiction stories from a different channel. Sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and some odd bands in between. Visit us at www.variantfrequencies.com. Hello, I'm Rick Stringer. Wow, it has been a long time. I've missed you all. Welcome to Season 5 of Variant Frequencies. That's right, Season 5. Some of you may have noticed that when I last talked about going to a season format, I said this would be Season 4. Well, I was wrong. We are actually going into our 5th year. Unbelievable. So much has happened. Over the first 4 years, we have won 4 awards and been nominated for several more. I can't tell you how great that makes me feel. We have some really fun things in store for you for Season 5. First, check out our new version of the website. It has a clean new look and even better features. You can check out each of the past seasons, find your favorite voices and authors, or just comment on our stories. Please check it out, and let us know what you think. Be sure to stick around for the promos at the end of our story. Our first story of the new season is by Matthew Warner. Matthew first approached me about this story back in January of this year. We decided at that time that it was a great Halloween story. So, since we started our new season in October to celebrate Halloween, it was the perfect fit. Another note about this story. The artwork is by Matthew's wife, Dina. We want to thank Dina for both inspiring Matthew to write this story and for letting us use her artwork. Now, on to our story. Life Insurance by Matthew Warner. Just before Hurricane Katrina slams into his New Orleans home, a father purchases an unusual life insurance policy from a voodoo priestess.
In the weeks that followed the dividing line in her life that was Hurricane Katrina, Taylor kept remembering the day her husband came home from work with the pygmy pumpkin and a new Band-Aid. It happened in late August, a few days before the hurricane's forecasted collision with Louisiana. Everyone in New Orleans's lower Ninth Ward was staggering through the day under a yoke of worry forged during previous hurricanes when the low-lying area had been flooded. "We going to the shelter tomorrow," Taylor's girlfriend said that afternoon as they watched over their kids at the playground. "How about you?" "I'll ask Jackson tonight," she answered as she repositioned her daughter Rachel on her lap. "They're letting him off early from the docks. Maybe we pack up and go after supper." Except Jackson didn't arrive home at their tiny apartment until after dark. He couldn't meet her gaze. Instead, playing with Rachel and ruffling their boy Steven's hair, saying,
"What a big boy you are. I got something for you today."
Taylor stood in the kitchen doorway with her arms crossed. "Where you been? I thought they let you off early."
"They did."
"Well?" Jackson watched their 3-year-old son half walk and half crawl to the sofa, where he collapsed giggling into the tattered cushions.
"Went to Bourbon Street and got presents for everyone."
"What? People talking about evacuation and you all buying presents? With what money?" That's when she noticed the Band-Aid on the inside of his left wrist. It looked small and out of place on the muscular arm. As always, the arm trembled from a hard day spent lifting heavy items into the backs of trucks. He was holding some kind of a small white vegetable in his hand, about the size of a tennis ball. Its stem was nearly as big as the rest of it. "The hell is that?"
"A pumpkin."
Crouching, Jackson beckoned to their son.
"Stephen, this is for you. Now, can you take care of it and love on it and not break it? It'll take care of you when I'm gone."
Strange thing to say, Taylor thought. She watched as Stephen approached his father and solemnly accepted the gift. He took it back to the couch where Rachel whined until he showed it to her.
"That ain't no pumpkin," Taylor said. "Where you get it?"
"Madame Bovard's."
He stood back up, wincing like he always did when straightening his back. He withdrew an envelope from his pocket and handed it to her.
"Now I know you crazy buying pumpkins from some voodoo fortune teller."
"She's more than a fortune teller."
"She's a fraud," Taylor said as she opened the envelope. "What the life insurance policy?"
Jackson nodded and looked at his toes.
"Like I said, got presents for everyone."
Behind him, Rachel cried when Stephen yanked the pygmy pumpkin from her hands. It slipped and landed on the floor like a stone, thunking solidly on the cheap tile, but not breaking as it rolled against Jackson's foot. Jackson picked it up and returned it to the boy's hand with a command to play nice.
"This a policy for $15,000? Taylor read. "How much you pay for this?"
He told her.
"Oh, Jesus, I was going to ask if we could use that money to get out of town till this hurricane blows over."
"It's better this way, Taylor."
He dropped onto the sofa next to their kids in that bone-tired way he always had at the end of the day. She threw the policy at him.
"You planning on killing yourself soon or something?"
Jackson struggled back onto his feet so he could return the document to her hand. He did it with a weariness that made her feel guilty.
"Can't kill myself to collect the money. It's a... what you call an exclusion. Please just take care of it. It'll take care of you when I'm gone."
"Like that pumpkin over there?"
He didn't answer, just returned to the sofa and ran a hand through his son's hair.
"Stupid man. How'd you cut yourself?"
"What?"
He blinked at her like he was drugged. So distracted. She tried again, softer this time. "Your Band-Aid." He glanced at his wrist.
"Scraped it on a box."
Taylor didn't give the bizarre events much more thought as the hurricane slammed into New Orleans that weekend. Even if Jackson hadn't spent their pin money on some life insurance policy, they wouldn't have had time to buy bus tickets out of town. They had no choice but to hunker down. Briefly, they considered sheltering at the Superdome, but dropped that idea when they heard priority was being given to the elderly and handicapped, of which they were neither, and that there were entry lines going on for blocks as National Guardsmen searched people for weapons and drugs. No, thank you. They'd just stick it out in their building, maybe hole up at the church if it got bad. The winds and rains battered the sides of their apartment building right on into Monday, and when the electricity went out, they kept the children entertained by candlelight. But by the end of the day, they believed the worst had passed. Then the levees protecting the city broke. Water poured into the apartment. Taylor, Jackson, and the children wound up on the roof with a half dozen other residents gawking at the swamp their neighborhood had become.
"I'm scared, Daddy,"
Stephen said through wet shivers as Jackson lifted him into a helicopter's rescue basket. Jackson patted the boy's hands, which clutched the tiny white pumpkin with frantic strength. Taylor and the children wrapped their arms around each other and cried as the helicopter flew them to the Superdome. They left Jackson behind on the apartment building's roof because the aircraft was full.
"He knew he was going to die," Taylor thought. "I'll never see him again."
But she was wrong. Jackson somehow found them at the Superdome 6 hours later among the thousands crammed inside.
"Your clothes are damp," Taylor said when she hugged him.
Her husband nodded, then turned his head so we could hack into his hand. His coughs came in short bursts that wheezed more than they produced anything. His face hung with a haggardness that she'd never seen on him before, not even after a double shift.
"I still have the pumpkin, Daddy,"
Stephen said and held it up for him to see. He was sitting in one of the athletic arena's front row chairs. An old woman covered with a military blanket slept in the chair behind him. Jackson smiled before dropping wearily into an empty seat. Although his clothes eventually dried, His coughs came more frequently over the next day, and he looked progressively more tired. Taylor tried to convince him to move to an empty cot on the main floor, but he insisted he could breathe better if he sat up. One morning, Jackson only took a single bite of the MRE meal he received before puking it back onto his plate. Taylor touched his face to find it burning with fever, so she fought through the crowds to a bathroom, hoping to wet a cloth to drape over his forehead. She retreated when told that there was no running water. Besides, the bathrooms were virtual septic pools, the floors swimming with toilet paper and feces-laden water. A harried rescue worker pressed a bottle of water into her hands. "Take this. Someone will be around to help him soon." As there was no longer any air conditioning, she nearly drowned in the sweltering atmosphere of the Superdome's floor as she crossed back to where her family sat. There was no longer any electricity, so she stumbled twice over reclined forms she couldn't see. Someone growled, "Watch where you're stepping, you fucking nigger." When she finally got back, Stephen announced, "Daddy's sleeping." The blanket had fallen off of Jackson's shoulders. Taylor pulled it back up, and her husband tipped over into the adjoining chair. He didn't move. Sitting on the dirty floor, Rachel began to cry. A FEMA worker gave Taylor a receipt for Jackson's body. After some Q&A, he filled out several forms for her to sign. The papers attested she was indigent and that the city of New Orleans should dispose of the body as it saw fit. He suggested she contact the authorities after a while to find out where her husband was buried. Taylor cried herself sick. By the weekend, she and the children were evacuated with thousands of others to the Houston Astrodome. She didn't know what to do. They had no savings and no relatives they could rely on. The children had head colds, causing Taylor to lose whole nights of sleep as she hovered over them, worrying that they would go the way of their father. Even the $15,000 life insurance policy Jackson had taken out on himself provided little comfort. Sitting on her cot on the floor of the Astrodome as her children and the other refugees slept around her, Taylor reread the policy. "It still won't be enough," she thought. "I got to raise two children without the help of a man. Got no house or job. Once we get out of here, we'll have enough money to live off of for a few months, but then we'll go hungry. My children will go hungry." For the first time ever, she wondered if she should give Stephen and Rachel up for adoption. Surely she was in hell. The next morning, she was contemplating this again. "Why are you crying, Mommy?" Stephen asked, when word came around that a nearby church was hosting an impromptu job fair for Katrina refugees. Taylor dressed the children in some of the clothes they received from rescue workers and headed over. When she arrived at the church's crowded fellowship hall, however, she found herself drawn to the small delegation of realtors who'd set up an information table in the corner. Nobody was lined up to talk to them, unlike the Houston Chamber of Commerce's armada of tables where merchants conducted job interviews. The realtors looked up at her when she appeared before them with Rachel in her arms and Stephen cowering behind her knee. "What can you do for me?" she said. "I got me some money from life insurance. I want to get out of the shelter." They asked her to sit down. They showed her information sheets about low-income rentals with 4 months of free rent and about cheap houses for sale on 30-year, no-money-down mortgages. A high-toned woman in a business suit with perhaps a kinder voice than eyes showed her an MLS printout about a blue and white house in a medium-sized town called Southwood. The house looked enormous for the price of $41,900, a 40-year-old split level with a yard and a driveway, 2 bedrooms, 1 bathroom. "I agree with you," the realtor said. "That's awful cheap for what you're getting. But it's also a fixer-upper, you see. We bought it on auction from the bank. It was a foreclosed property. We had a crew go in and clean it up and repair the gushing pipes in the basement and cure the termite infestation. It had lead-based paint in all the rooms, and we fixed that up, too." "So is it a dump or isn't it?" Taylor said and returned the printout to the table. She pulled Stephen's thumb out of his mouth. He'd taken up the habit the day after Jackson died. "It's livable. It's also in an area where property taxes are almost nothing, and at that mortgage level, you're looking at a monthly payment of only about $250 a month." Unsure if she was being scammed, Taylor continued talking to the woman, who assured her Southwood was a pleasant one-horse town, and like New Orleans, it wasn't necessary to own a car. There was also a strong African-American community, plus many small shops downtown in need of minimum wage laborers. Laundromats, bowling alleys, restaurants, gift shops. The woman showed her demographic printouts and articles. I also know of at least 10 self-employed babysitters, cheap babysitters you can rely on so you can work. How about church preschools? My babies need a Christian upbringing. The high-toned woman laughed a little too loudly and smoothed her impeccable suit. Sweetheart, they don't call it the Bible Belt for nothing. Now, let me tell you about some of the other benefits of owning a home. What kind of deductions do you currently claim on your income taxes? What kind of what? Taylor said. She picked the printout back up on the blue and white house. Getting to Southwood was surprisingly easy. The bus tickets were free on account of the relief efforts, and Taylor had nothing to move except for herself and her children. Aside from the miniature pumpkin Stephen still held onto and occasionally addressed as Daddy, they had no possessions but a few changes of clothes. Before boarding the bus, Taylor imposed on the high-toned realtor once more. I need some place to deposit my life insurance money. I'm really not the one to help you open a bank account, sweetheart, the woman said. Well then, sweetheart, I guess you won't be getting that sales commission you want. The woman suddenly changed her mind and assisted her. She even helped Taylor contact a life insurance company to arrange the wire transfer to her new account. Once in Southwood, they checked into a dumpy Econo Inn that looked like the most palatial palace in the world compared to the shelters. They ate a real meal at the Denny's on the corner and washed their clothes in the motel room's tub. An associate of the high-toned realtor phoned her the next day and asked when she'd be available to close on her new home. For the first time since Jackson died, Taylor allowed herself to smile. It wasn't even that bad of a house. With his new paint job, the same color in and out, and freshly mowed grass, it looked downright upper class compared to their apartment in the lower ninth. She shushed herself. Don't think about the old apartment and your old life. Not today. Dry your tears. The neighbors never came to visit, but were quiet and kept to themselves. After a week passed and they didn't plant a burning cross on her lawn, Taylor began to relax. Oh, the house wasn't fantastic by any means. With no insulation and with walls as thin as wrapping paper and a tiny hole in the upper bedroom's window. And Southwood wasn't what it was cracked up to be. The shopping district where she hoped to get a job was a half-hour walk away, and the grocery store and Goodwill store was a 20-minute walk in the other direction, and there wasn't no city bus like she'd expected, but she was thankful to have some place to live.
Don't let yourself cry. Jackson would want you to be strong.
After the first week, she reluctantly purchased a used car she found through the classified ads. The old green Dodge the seller drove into her driveway had a rusted roof and torn seat cushions and an engine, the man explained, that needed a new quart of oil with every second tank of gas. But he was only asking $500 for it. 10 minutes of haggling later, Taylor paid him $450 and took him home.
I hate driving, she thought the whole way. I don't even have a driver's license, but I need a car if we're going to get around this town, if I'm going to find a job. Our lives will get better because I'm doing what I gotta do. Once I get a job, things will look up.
It took her a whole other week to land that job. By that time, she'd filled up the car's fuel tank twice and the oil pan once. And at $3 a gallon for gas, it surely ate a hole through the new credit card she'd acquired. The kids' head colds had finally gone away to be replaced by unexplained nightmares and daytime screaming fits, the screaming tizzies her mother used to call them. And she'd spent another $450 repairing the house's air conditioning unit. Her new job was cleaning rooms at the palatial palace, the Econo Inn, wiping out ashtrays and scrubbing stains out of beds, and generally feeling like her late husband after a long day of work, all for the minimum wage of $5.15 an hour and no benefits. And even then, she couldn't work as hard or as long as she would have preferred because babysitters weren't nearly so easy to acquire as the high-toned bitch had said. Worse, only one church had a decent preschool program, and then that was for only half the day. She'd seen all of 3 black folks in the entire town. One night, after she fed her children their 4th meal on a row of ramen noodles, Taylor trudged into her furnitureless living room and sat down beside the phone book. With a heavy sigh, she thumbed through the contents in search of a number for food stamps. She told her soul. Don't let yourself cry. But her soul wasn't listening. Oh, Jackson, honey, I miss you. By mid-October, the life insurance money was almost gone. Her Econo Inn wages were always spent before she earned them, and she charged ever more of her bills to the credit card. She contemplated whether to go to one of those cash advance businesses out near the highway. She worried what would happen when she was forced to choose between paying the mortgage and feeding her children. Not that she was doing such a great job on that last account. Stephen and Rachel no longer had their baby fat cheeks, and their eyes hung in sockets deeper than she remembered. They no longer smiled. They spent most of their time lying in the pile of blankets and pillows that function as their living room furniture, taking naps or listlessly pushing around toys she'd bought at the dollar store. As they didn't own a TV, she spent most evenings trying to play with them or read them stories from the Reader's Digest issues she stole from work. But they hardly paid any attention to her, it seemed, except as the utility that bathed, dressed, and fed them. They never looked her in the eye. They just missed their daddy, she told herself, fighting the worry that she was a bad mother. It seemed that the only thing that retained any vitality in the house was the miniature pumpkin Stephen had brought with him from New Orleans. The thing was impervious to decay and had remained rock hard. The boy placed it directly beneath the living room window and spent many hours seated before it, talking to it in a low, mumbling stream of nonsense. Whenever he did this, Rachel would sit or lie nearby, sometimes reaching out to caress it. It was like the pumpkin was some religious artifact and her children the priests, but Taylor knew it was just a game to them, that or they were attached to it on account of its being the last thing their father gave them. She tried a few times to catch what Stephen was saying to it, but when she came near, he stopped his guttural conversation and wandered away to do something else. "What you saying to the pumpkin, son?" He always shook his head in response. As Halloween approached and she contemplated getting a real pumpkin for them to carve, Jackson's gift to the children finally began to show its age by changing color from albino white to a burnt orange. Gas buildup stretched the skin until it was visibly bloated, and she knew she'd have to throw it away soon. "We gonna have to throw your pumpkin away, sweetie," she said to Stephen one morning. They were preparing to leave the house for preschool and work. Stephen opened his eyes wide and his mouth wider. "No, no, no!" Breaking away from Taylor's grip by the front door where she struggled to put his coat on him, Stephen ran back into the living room. He screamed and sobbed as he collapsed in a heap before his pumpkin. Rachel crawled after him, shrieking. It was the most life either of them had shown in weeks. "It's okay, honey, it's okay," Taylor said as she struggled to hold her children. "Mama won't take your pumpkin away. You can keep it as long as you want." Tears and snot streamed down Stephen's face as he huddled around the pumpkin and continued to bawl. Rachel rolled onto her back and screeched as she beat her hands and feet on the floor. She appeared to be doing it for sheer pleasure. Finally, Taylor coaxed Stephen into letting go of his prize and accompanying her back to the front door. They resumed the interrupted process of donning shoes and coat. She knew she was going to be late for work and knew with equal certainty that she'd have to throw away the pumpkin during the night when Stephen was asleep. She knew, finally, at last, that her baby had an emotional problem, and it was wearing off on his sister. And why wouldn't he have an emotional problem after all he'd been through? "That pumpkin is Stephen's daddy to him," she realized. "He knows his dad is gone, but he ain't accepted it yet. That's why he's not playing or eating, right? He's grieving, and when that pumpkin goes and... Lord help me, it has to go before it goes rotten and brings some disease into the house. He's going to cry for his daddy like he never cried before. Rachel, she's too young to understand it all. She probably don't remember Jackson that much now. She just does what Stephen does. But Stephen, oh my baby." "No, throw daddy away," Stephen said as she led him to the car. "No, I won't, sugar. I promise I won't." And as they left the house for the day, she wondered at the lies parents told their kids. Stephen would forgive her eventually, especially if she claimed no knowledge of the pumpkin's disappearance in the coming night. But would she be able to forgive herself? The preschool teacher was also a babysitter, thank God, who provided services for only half of what Taylor made an hour. It enabled her to work a full day at the Econo Wynn 5 days a week, so that night, they all didn't get home until supper time. When they entered the living room, Taylor screamed at what she found. The pumpkin! God almighty, it had grown during the day. 4 feet across now and nearly as tall as she was. Its growth had pushed it away from the window where it had quietly soaked up fall sunlight for a month and a half. It lay on top of the piles of blankets and pillows where the children normally played. The burnt orange of that morning had darkened into fine red lines in some areas, like the veins on a leaf. The stem on top looked like a tree branch and was as thick around as her arm. Stephen stood beside her and spoke quietly. Daddy? He stuck his thumb into his mouth. Rachel giggled and crawled toward the monstrosity. No, Rachel! Taylor scooped up the girl and retreated into the next room. Stephen! She snapped, and the boy followed her. Big, Stephen said. Yes, honey, it's big. I want you to stay in here with your sister. She moved automatically now, approaching the pumpkin and preparing to push it out the door, maternal instinct switching on and refusing to allow her to think or feel her own fear. There was a thing in her house, bloated with disease and despair. God knew what else. If she didn't get it out of here, it might burst open like an overripe tomato and spew infestation everywhere. Breathing heavily, she reached out to it, measuring it with her hands and eyes. Mommy? I'm right here, sweetie. You stay there with your sister until Mommy comes back. Except that it wasn't bloated with gases, not that she could see. Its skin, Lord help her, it pulsed. It was the skin of a great orange elephant. She ran her fingers along its long vertical creases, feeling the vibrations of some internal engine of pestilence as it swelled. It kept growing bigger. She could see it happening even as she stood there. Mommy, is Daddy sick? No more messing around. Taylor threw herself against it, screaming with exertion until it moved. She repositioned her attack, angling the pumpkin toward the doorway into the front foyer. Eventually, she got a rhythm going and was able to establish a rocking momentum to walk it toward the door. Its skin quivered under her fingers. Thud. She had reached the doorway to exit the living room. The opening was surely a third wider than the front door that the pumpkin would also have to fit through, but the pumpkin was already too big. She tried again and was rewarded with another thud. Mommy's saying bad words. She kept trying, but it was no use. Angry now, she ran into the kitchen and returned with a butcher knife, which she stabbed into the orange flesh. It was like striking a rock. The blade pinged and deflected. Good God. This wasn't a pumpkin, it was a goddamn boulder. The claw hammer she fetched from the basement yielded the same results, both with the claw and the hammer. Ping. Thud. Watching from the next room where she sat beside her brother, Rachel laughed and clapped. The pumpkin's growth accelerated despite her best efforts. Within a half hour, it breached the drywall ceiling of the living room. Within 45 minutes, it touched the walls. Taylor took the kids and fled the house when the wall studs began to groan. It took another 10 minutes to find a neighbor who was at home and who would call 911 for them. My house is on fire, she said. It was easier than the truth. With that done, there was nothing left to do but stand on the street and wait. And to watch as she once again lost her home. By now, night had fallen and she could clearly see the way the pumpkin glowed where she thought she'd only imagined it before. When something flashed white and blue inside the house and the electricity winked out, the glow seemed brighter. She could see it through the upstairs windows now. It was slowly devouring the inside of her house, crushing its walls and floors, leaving only the shell. Cancer. It's a tumor in my home. Oh God, oh God, oh God. Why have you forsaken me? Rachel wasn't laughing anymore. She was sucking her thumb like her older brother, who hung onto the edge of her skirt and swayed as if he was about to faint. She held out her arms and whined to be picked up, so Taylor picked her up and cried into her hair. Where the hell were those firemen, she called. For Christ's sake, where were her neighbors? Didn't anyone care? When the worst happened, it happened all at once. Like the pumpkin was a balloon, Satan had suddenly squeezed from beneath the ground, causing the upper part to explosively expand and bulge. One moment she was looking at her house with glowing orange pumpkin skin filling all the windows, listening to the wood groan and creak, an occasional sound of bursting pipes, a horrible undertone like the sound of paper being crumpled. And the next moment, the walls ruptured and fell apart like cheap stage scenery. The pumpkin grew fully half of its growth in those last seconds, swelling outward so quickly that the roof and chimney simply launched upward and outward, breaking apart into pieces that crashed into other houses and landed on adjacent streets. Leaves the size of sailboat sails draped downward from the huge stem at the top. Finally, a neighbor appeared beside her, just a boy on a bike. Taylor barely noticed him as he took in the house-sized pumpkin that had displaced her home. He whistled low and said, "Halloween sure is big around here." Taylor could hardly see through her tears. Letting Rachel slide to the ground, she stumbled away from them toward the glowing orb. "Take me," she thought. "Just take me. Put me out of my misery." As she crossed broken glass and wood, she felt heat radiating off its skin, and she imagined she was falling into the sun. Surely death wasn't such an unpleasant thing. The grave wouldn't be cold. It would be warm and inviting, like this was. This was the opposite of the flood that had destroyed her home in the Lower Ninth. This was large and warm, as big as Jackson's love for them, which is why it was such a fitting end for her, the way it mocked her with that love, even as it destroyed her home again. She sobbed as she flattened a hand on the granite-like skin. "Take me." The skin along one of the vertical creases parted and revealed an opening. Taylor went inside. The glow inside the pumpkin was so bright that it hurt her eyes. She blinked and shielded her gaze as she staggered forward into the pumpkin's hot maw. "Take me, take me." She stumbled and fell headlong and landed on a carpeted floor. She looked up and found herself beside a familiar, battered couch. It was their couch, from the apartment on the Lower Ninth. How did it get here? She was in a large, pumpkin-colored room. Pumpkin seeds hung in strands from the ceiling, except that it was also filled with their old belongings. She recognized the couch, the old grandfather clock that didn't work, and Jackson's scarred TV. Wooden stairs rose to a large, closed door. "Mommy?" Taylor whirled to see Stephen and Rachel standing in the opening behind her. She felt a surge of panic. "No, no, get out! It isn't safe!" "Mommy? Mommy, look!" "Stephen, I said, look!" He pointed behind her and smiled for the first time in weeks. Even Rachel was grinning. Taylor turned, following her children's gaze to the top of the wooden stairs. The door there hung open. A smiling, familiar figure stood on the other side.
Thank you for listening to Life Insurance, written and narrated by Matthew Warner. We will have more information about him in our show notes and on our MySpace and LiveJournal pages. To find out more about Variant Frequencies, please go to our website at www.variantfrequencies.com. If you like Variant Frequencies, tell your friends about us. Thank you from the Variant Frequencies team. As a black snowfall blankets the failed cities on Christmas Eve, The arrival of 99 mysterious steel chambers sets a series of far-from-blessed events in motion. 8 people become links in a deadly chain that will either tether innocent lives to safety or strangle any hope for their future. And as each part of the story unfolds, we learn that above all things, Christmas in the failed cities is a feverishly struck balance between the constant threat of violence and the briefest, most bittersweet moments of joy. Variant Frequencies presents The Failed Cities, Path of Darkness by Matt Wallace, starting on December 1st and ending on Christmas Day. Catch The Failed Cities, Half of Darkness at variantfrequencies.com.